Conversation 1.
Hello, Doctor.
Hello, please take a seat. I have your test results here, and it's good news. The blood test came back clear. There is no indication of any digestive issues.
So then, why do I feel so poorly all the time?
It's probably due to overwork and stress.
No, it can't be. I've always been working hard, but I've never felt stress. Other people suffer and complain about that, but I don't. It must be something else.
What you have just described is a common sentiment. Many people who suffer from stress fail to recognize it. You told me you often work long into the night, right?
Yes, most days, in fact. But I've been doing that for about 20 years now.
That doesn't matter. You could have been suffering from stress for 20 years without knowing it, and now it's catching up to you.
But what about my feeling tired all the time and not being able to sleep well at night?
Those are common consequences of stress. And if you don't sleep well, then of course you will feel fatigued. I'm going to prescribe some special sleeping pills for you. They have a soft, gentle effect and are made from natural ingredients, so your stomach should tolerate them fine, and there shouldn't be any negative side effects. Take one with your dinner and come see me after a month. If there is no improvement, I'll give you something stronger.
Thank you, Doctor.
That's not all. You should try and work less. Is there any way you can decrease your workload?
I'd have to think about it. I'm a restaurant manager, and this industry is very competitive. There are many things to keep track of and stay on top of.
I recommend you think about delegating some responsibilities to someone else. I'm not asking you to retire, just to slow down a bit. It's for your own health. Questions 1 to 4 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 1. What do we learn about the man from his test results? Question 2. What does the woman think is a common phenomenon among many people? Question 3. What does the woman say she will do for the man? Question 4. What does the man say about the industry he is engaged in?
Conversation 2.
Today on People in the News, our guest is John Williams. The name may not sound familiar to you, but John was once an acclaimed basketball player. John, you stunned fans by leaving the sport at just 25. Why did you retire so early?
Meg, I loved being an athlete, but I didn't love being a celebrity. I was in the limelight when I was still a high school student and went professional right after high school graduation, which was a mistake. I was a shy kid, and I wasn't ready for all the media attention.
But walking away from millions of dollars at the height of your career? Most people wouldn't be able to resist the lure of such a high salary. When you left the sport, there was speculation that you were having issues with your teammates or even an injury.
Not at all. It was hard to quit. I was tempted to stay in the game because I loved basketball and I loved my team. As for money, I turned professional at 18. So I'd actually earned a lot and saved most of it because I had great financial advisors. I knew basketball wasn't a career with a lot of longevity for most players, so I wanted to change careers while I was still young.
Okay, that was 20 years ago, and you're back in the news. You've created a foundation that works to get more kids playing team sports. Why?
I went to university and I studied public health and learned about the seriousness of the obesity epidemic, particularly among kids and adolescents in poor communities. I've spent the last 2 decades trying to alleviate the problem. The foundation is just the latest attempt.
The foundation uses private donations to support basketball teams for girls and boys in primary school, right?
Actually, we support teams for secondary school students too, and also have some public funding. Questions 5 to 8 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 5. Why did John Williams leave the sport of basketball at just 25? Question 6. What does the man say about basketball as a career for most players? Question 7. What do we learn from the woman about John Williams 20 years later? Question 8. What has the man spent the last 2 decades trying to do?
Passage 1. Kate Atkinson was born in York, England, in 1951. She worked hard to gain her credentials as an author. She studied English literature at university in Scotland. After graduating in 1974, she researched a doctorate on American literature. Later, she taught at the university she graduated from and began writing short stories in 1981. She began writing for women's magazines after winning the 1986 Woman's Own Short Story Competition. Her first novel, Behind the Scenes at the Museum, won the 1995 UK Book of the Year Award. The book is set in Yorkshire and has been adapted for radio, theater, and TV. She has written two plays for a theater in Edinburgh. The first was called Nice, and the second, Abandonment, performed as part of the Edinburgh Festival in August 2000. Whatever genre Atkinson writes in, her books touch on the themes of love and loss and how to carry on. They are always presented with ingenuity and a wicked sense of humor. Her books tend to be populated by odd, sometimes sinful, and generally flawed eccentrics, who become credible by virtue of being so fully realized. Her books have frequently been described as comedies of manners, that is to say, comedies that represent the complex and sophisticated code of behavior current in fashionable circles of society, where appearances count more than true moral character. A comedy of manners tends to reward its clever and deceitful characters rather than punish their bad deeds. The humor of a comedy of manners relies on verbal wit and playful teasing.
Questions 9 to 11 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 9. When did Kate Atkinson begin to write for women's magazines? Question 10. What do Kate Atkinson's books touch on? Question 11. What do we learn about the clever and deceitful characters in a comedy of manners? Passage 2. Why is adaptability an important skill to exercise in the workplace? Simply put, adaptability is a skill employers are increasingly looking for. When you spend time learning a new task rather than resisting it, your productivity goes up. You can also serve as an example to your co-workers who may be having trouble adapting and can help lead your team forward. Strategy consultant Dori Clark explains it to us this way. I'd say that adaptability is an important skill in the workplace because, frankly, circumstances change. Competitors introduce new products, the economy might enter a recession, customer preferences differ over time, and more. If you shake your fist at the sky and say, why can't it stay the same, that's not going to do very much good. Instead, you need to recognize when circumstances have changed so you can take appropriate action based on what is, rather than how you wish the world would be. That enables you to make more accurate, informed, and effective choices. Also, the workplace itself has been evolving. Today's work culture and management style is often based on teamwork rather than a rigid hierarchy. Brainstorming, which requires creativity, flexibility, and emotional intelligence, is a typical problem-solving technique. Employees who are unable or unwilling to participate will not easily move forward in the company. Employees who are flexible demonstrate other skills too. They can reprioritize quickly when changes occur and suggest additional modifications when something's not working. They can also regroup quickly when a setback occurs, adapting to the new situation confidently and without overreacting.
Questions 12 to 15 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 12. Why does the speaker say adaptability is an important skill to exercise in the workplace? Question 13. What does adaptability enable us to do, according to strategy consultant Dori Clark? Question 14. What do we learn about today's work culture from the passage? Question 15. What are employees with adaptability able to do when changes occur? Recording 1. What makes humans different from other species? Some philosophers argue it's morals or ethics, while some scientists assert it's our greater cognitive development. But I argue that the main difference is our desire to combat routine. This makes being creative a biological mandate, as what we seek in art and technology is surprise, not simply a fulfillment of expectations. As a result, a wild imagination has characterized the history of our species. We build intricate habitats, devise complex recipes for our food, wear clothes that reflect constant changes in fashion, communicate with elaborate signs, symbols, and sounds, and travel between habitats on wings and wheels of our own design. To satisfy our appetite for novelty, innovation is key. But who innovates? Now, many people, both laymen and experts, believe that only geniuses innovate. But I believe that innovation is not something that only a few people do. The innovative drive lives in every human brain, and the resulting war against the repetitive is what powers the massive changes that distinguish one generation from the next. The drive to create the new is a trait of being human. We build cultures by the hundreds and tell new stories by the millions. We create and surround ourselves with things that have never existed before, while animals do not. But where do our new ideas come from? According to many, new ideas come from seemingly nowhere to great minds. From this perspective, new ideas are almost like magic. They come in a flash of inspiration to a select few. However, the reality is that, across the spectrum of human activities, prior work propels the creative process. We may think of innovation as being the result of inspiration or genius, but it's really the result of developing the ideas of others further. This happens in technology, where one invention enables or inspires further inventions, and it happens in the arts, as writers, composers, and painters use the work of previous artists in their own work. The human brain works from precedent. We take the ideas we've inherited and put them together into some new shape. What is a true creator? Is a creator a genius who makes something out of nothing? No, creators are simply humans who use what they inherit, who absorb the past and manipulate it to create possible futures. Thus, humans are creators as a rule rather than as an exception.
Questions 16 to 18 are based on the recording you have just heard. Question 16. What question does the speaker address in this talk? Question 17. What does the speaker believe about innovation? Question 18. How does the human brain work according to the speaker?
Recording 2. While an increasing number of people are trying to eat less meat, a market research team has found in its latest fashion and sustainability report that the trend is now spreading from kitchen to closet. It found animal welfare came top of a list of issues that people considered before buying clothes, with 42% saying it was important to them. The researchers of the team predicted that the next year would see a boom in animal-free shoe collections, since they heard shoppers of all ages say they would buy footwear designated as vegan, meaning the goods were produced without using any animal or animal part. As well as being on trend, and with a much better ring to it than synthetic leather, the vegan label does convey an important extra distinction. If you label something as vegan, and the whole product needs to be animal-free. That means checking things like the glue that holds the shoe together, for example, and the chemicals used for finishing them. At the top end, some of the world-renowned fashion designers have avoided leather and fur for some time. In fact, some of the companies are now exploring a leather substitute and a silk replacement made from mushrooms. The Animal Free Product Society says they've seen a boom in products registered with the vegan trademark. In 2018, there were 119. So far this year, it says, an unprecedented 1,956 have been registered. New products are being added daily. There are fur coats that are vegan, plastic vegan belts, and shoes made from tree bark or natural rubber labeled vegan. These new products aren't coming at an extra cost to consumers, though. Vegan boots cost the same as the leather originals. New Look, one of the first reputable store chains to use the vegan trademark prices ballet shoes at £7.99 and the vegan laptop handbag at £29.99, comparable with its other products. This signifies a change. In the past, ethical products, whether they were fair trade or organic, came at a premium. However, it is unclear whether these new products can be considered ethical. The debate over durability, crop-growing impacts, pollution, and recyclability is a complicated one, not to mention the ethics around the working conditions for people making the products, whatever the component materials. Environmental campaigners advise that the best approach is to buy less, never mind what the item is made of.
Questions 19 to 21 are based on the recording you have just heard. Question 19. What has a market research team found in its latest fashion and sustainability report? Question 20. What have some world-renowned fashion designers done for some time? Question 21. What does the speaker say is unclear concerning vegan products?
Recording 3. Earlier this month, the think tank called Onward published a report, A Question of Degree, which argues that degrees in the creative arts are not good value for money. Ministers, according to Onward, should crack down on courses that offer extremely limited value for money to students 10 years after graduation, restricting the ability of such courses to recruit new students if the average graduate earns below the student loan's payment threshold. Courses like science, technology, engineering, and math, and economics, where the average graduate earns a lot, should be favored. The report provides insight into a government review, which looks at how to reform technical education and how to ensure students get good value for money. At first glance, it might even seem like Onward have a point. According to their data, the majority of creative arts students earn less than £25,000 a year, 10 years after graduation. The average male creative arts students, indeed, apparently earn much less than they would had they simply never gone to university. This isn't really good for anyone, and it's certainly no good for graduates, who are forced to endure a lifestyle where they can never save up, never buy a house, never hope to retire. Onward have identified a real problem. Creative arts graduates from top universities like Oxford, with a high proportion of privately educated students, have fairly good work prospects, while 40% of all graduates, regardless of their degree, are on less than £25,000 a year, 5 years after graduation. This suggests that the problem isn't really to do with specific students studying specific degrees, but really with the economy as a whole. Regardless of what they've studied, young people find it hard to get ahead, unless they're lucky enough to be born with successful parents. If ministers want to make education pay for young people, they need to look beyond the higher education sector, towards the wider world. The rewards that education gives us are not measurable. They are not always instantly obvious, and certainly not always direct. An education makes you a different person from the one you would have been if you hadn't received it. We need to look at the value of education not in the context of a bank balance, but of a life. If we continue to allow ourselves to be distracted with talk of value for money, we will all be made poorer as a result.
Questions 22 to 25 are based on the recording you have just heard. Question 22. What does Onward's report propose ministers should do? Question 23. What does the speaker think of Onward's arguments? Question 24. What do we learn about British college graduates 5 years after graduation? Question 25. What does the speaker say actually accounts for the problem identified by Onward?